I'm going to read to us from Micah 4 to start with. So if any of you do have your Bibles, you can turn to Micah 4, but if not, I will just read out. Oh, we've actually got the text. That's good. So yes, Micah 4, and I'm going to read through to verse 5. So I'm reading from the New International Version. The Mountain of the Lord. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the nations. It will be raised above the hills, and peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war any more. Every man will sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken. So, thanks. This week, we are continuing our sermon series looking at the book of Micah, the Old Testament prophet. We've had a fair few weeks off as a church since our last Micah message, and a fair bit of distraction in the world in recent weeks. So I thought it may be helpful to recap and refresh our minds as to where we got up to and give a bit of context. So in the first week we looked at Micah, we were introduced to this prophet of the Israelites in Judah, who brought this message to the people of Judea around 700 years before Jesus was born. And in our first week, Sam told us about Micah's lament, if you remember that, the way his heart was breaking for the people of Israel, who'd abandoned God, they'd exploited the poor, idolized evil, despised justice, and distorted all that is right. And it's a pretty long charge sheet against Israel. Micah warned that because of their wickedness, God would remove his protection from them. He prophesied they'd be defeated in war by their enemies and scattered, thrown into exile or even taken into slavery. And this would have been a hard-hitting message for the Israelites, who were already a little on edge, to understate the matter, as they were all too aware of the armies of the mighty Assyrian Empire sweeping aggressively through the region with Judah in their sights. In our second week looking at Micah, Sam told us about the other side of Micah's message, his message of hope and deliverance. He prophesied that after this terrible defeat that was coming, God would once again gather his people together to send a king to lead his people, and they would follow their king to victory. In our third week, Nick looked at Micah's call to the Israelites to repent for the wrong they'd done, and we got thinking about a word not often used today, rebuke. Decrying evil and speaking against wrong action. We thought about the church today and how we can directly and effectively call out evil in the world in the way that Micah did during his time. And so to this week, we're looking at the verses in Micah that point to God's future promises, especially in relation to Jesus as bringer of peace to the world. So, for the next 15 to 20 minutes or so, we're going to especially consider Micah 4, especially this message about beating swords into ploughs, transforming the instruments of war into tools for nurture and new life. I'm going to give you some context to the passage, tell you two stories of radical peacemakers, and tell you how I've tried to apply this passage to my own life, and give you some questions to go away and think about. So firstly, what does Micah say about the person of Jesus, about 7 years before Christ was actually born? Micah is well known as the prophet who first heralded that the Messiah would come out of Bethlehem, a small village just south of Jerusalem. Micah 2, chapter 5, verse 2 says, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah," can't say that word, "though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come one for me who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old ancient times." Micah proclaims that this ruler will be king not just of Israel, but of all humanity, of all the earth. He calls him Majesty. His greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. He will be their peace. The mountains of the Lord's temple will be raised up and peoples will stream to it. And Jesus will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord. So this is the prophecy of the person of Jesus, the king we're to expect. And what does this king bring? What will this look like in people's lives? In other words, what will his kingdom be like? And Micah chapter 4 answers this question. It tells us about his future kingdom. He says that they will beat their swords into ploughs and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. This exact word-for-word passage is actually found in both the book of Micah and the book of Isaiah, who was another prophet around the same time. And experts explain this by saying that these passages could actually have been a later addition to the book of Micah, possibly that they were around at the time as a common liturgical text, like used in worship as groups. It could have been dated a couple of hundred years after Micah was actually preaching. At the earliest, they reckon it could have been written around the fall of the time of the fall of Jerusalem to the invading King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, which resulted in the destruction of the city and the destruction of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. This is important to understand. It means that these particular words emerged from some of the darkest war-torn times for the people of Israel. And they're powerful words. They represent a vision of lasting peace amongst nations and neighbours. They paint, I think, a really visceral picture, asking us to imagine the very instruments of war, the swords and the spears that are designed for destruction, transformed before our eyes into tools to cultivate the earth, to create fertile ground, to grow new life and produce the food that will nourish and sustain us. This is the promise of the future. A future we're told will come about under the rule of the Messiah. However, I think as well as a prophecy, it can be a calling for us now to lay down our weapons and strive for peace. Some of you will probably have heard of the theologian Jim Wallace, a pastor and writer who is well known for his advocacy on issues of peace. And he sums up this contrast between the biblical hope and the here and now by saying this: biblical hope comes from having a vision of the future that enables us to live even now in its promise. It means bringing the future into the present with power and authority. Hope in something new and more promising is always the greatest spark for change. So this is biblical hope. It doesn't mean we sit back and accept war and violence as normal, something just inevitable, while we just wait for the utopian future to be bestowed upon us. In fact, this passage from Micah and Isaiah actually reminds me of a song that we used to sing in assembly. I was at junior school here in St. Peter's here in Ruddington. And as I look back and remember the fact that we used to sing this song nearly every week, I realised it was quite an unusual song for an assembly. It was a 1950s country folk peace song by a guy called Ed McCurdy, written in 1950, and it was covered by everyone from Johnny Cash to Simon and Garfunkel. Some of you may be guessing or know of it, but the song's called Last Night I Had the Strangest Dream. Does anyone know that song? Certainly nobody else my age knows that song, but I had to sing it every single week. No way. I will, however, read the lyrics out because they, for me, they're a little bit of an echo of Micah. So the lyrics go: last night I had the strangest dream I ever dreamed before. I dreamed the world had all agreed to put an end to war. I dreamed I saw a mighty room. The room was filled with men, and the paper they were signing said they'd never fight again. And when the papers were all signed and a million copies made, they all joined hands and bowed their heads, and grateful prayers were prayed. And the people in the streets below were dancing round and round, and guns and swords and uniforms were scattered on the ground. In 1971, the singer John Denver, favourite of mine, sung this song to many tens of thousands of people at the famous protests outside the White House in Washington decrying the Vietnam War. So why did John Denver sing these words to that crowd today, that day? I think it was because of, going back to what Jim Wallace said, hope in something new and more promising is always the greatest spark for change. So today I'd like us to use this passage from Micah chapter 4 as our inspiration as we look at this really big, difficult topic about conflict, violence and war. We're going to look at what it means to be a peacemaker, to transform swords into ploughs, and turns our turn our defences and our instruments of war into tools of nurture and new life. So that's big stuff, but I think we're up for it. So I'm going to start by telling you a couple of real-life stories of radical peacemakers. So these are real people, and I hope that these two short stories might inspire you. Ordinary people who have done extraordinary things in the pursuit of peace and reconciliation. My first story concerns a group called the Christian Peacemaker Teams, or CPT. They may be known to some of you. They weren't known to me before reading about this, but CPT is an international organisation set up to support teams of peace workers in conflict areas around the world. These teams believe that they can lower the levels of violence through non-violent direct action, human rights documentation and non-violence training. They sum up their work as being committed to getting in the way in conflict zones, literally standing in the gap. They have a full-time core of about 30 activists who currently work across the world in Colombia, Iraq, the West Bank and Mexico. And these teams are supported by over 150 reservists who spend 2 weeks to 2 months a year on location. Now, back in November 2005, four men from a Christian peacemakers team were taken hostage in Iraq. They were taken hostage by a terrorist cell, and a high-profile hostage crisis followed. The eyes of the world were on the four kidnapped men, and these men were from all over the globe, of all backgrounds, aged between 33 and 74 years old. They were Tom Fox of Virginia, USA, a leader of youth programs in the Quaker Church; Norman Kember of Pinner in London, a retired professor of medical physics; James Loney of Canada, who was a program coordinator for the Christian Peacemakers; and Harmeet Sinsodan, a Canadian electrical engineer. And on the 26th of November 2005, these four men were in Iraq. They were travelling by car to an important meeting with the Muslim Clerics Association. They were going to see this important group of Sunni religious leaders formed in 2003, and they were really influential in the region. They were trying to build bridges there to call for an end to violence in Iraq. The four men were about 100 metres from the entrance to the mosque where the meeting was about to take place when their car was stopped, and they were taken by armed gunmen into hostage. And in the hostage crisis that followed, the hostages condemned the action of the kidnappers, but maintained pacifist principles by refusing to call for any violent rescue effort. Their distinctive dedication to non-violence led to widespread sympathy and support from all sides, with calls for their release coming from diverse Muslim, Christian and secular groups across the West and the Middle East. They were held for 4 months, and tragically one of the hostages, Tom Fox, was shot and killed by his captors. The remaining three were freed in a military operation. When Tom Fox's death was announced, the Christian Peacemaker Teams released a statement of condolences, also asking that the world not vilify or demonise others, no matter what they've done. They quoted Tom himself, saying, "We reject violence to punish anyone. We forgive those who consider us their enemies." Even after the three remaining hostages were rescued, they thanked the military but made a point of saying that they were grateful that no shots were fired during their rescue. And later that year, they held a press conference where they publicly forgave their kidnappers at St. Ethelburga's Centre for Reconciliation in London. It was exactly a year ago to the day of that press release that their kidnappers had threatened to murder them. At the press conference, they announced they would not testify at the trial of their kidnappers if there was any risk that their captors would face a death penalty. They said, "We bear no malice towards them and have no wish for retribution. We unconditionally forgive our captors. We have no desire to punish them. Should those who have been charged with holding us hostage be brought to trial, we ask that they be granted all possible leniency. We categorically lay aside any rights we may have over them." Years later, the kidnappers were arrested by the Iraqi police, but the three men still refused to testify against them. These men lived radically counterculturally. They embodied Jesus' command to turn the other cheek and forgive in the most demanding of circumstances. And what struck me about this story was actually the fact that because their actions were so distinctive, the whole world sat up and took notice. It really was headline news. The whole world saw that there was something very different about their approach, their beliefs. They modelled a completely different way of operating that stands out from the crowd. And I did feel quite challenged by this. And I ask myself, how often do we actually see Christians doing this? How often do I do it? I did a Bible study course last year called A Year in God's Time. And one of the questions they asked us to go away and ask our friends and colleagues and family members was the question, how do you know that I'm a Christian? Now, what do you think they might say? Well, Jake laughed and said, well, you do bake a lot of cake. A lot of people said, well, primarily it's, I know you go to church on a Sunday, don't you? Now, sharing our thoughts as a group with everybody else who did that little exercise, a lot of people said the same thing. So, you know, apart from our choice of venue to hang out on a Sunday morning, there often wasn't a massively distinctive characteristic in our behaviour that our non-Christian friends or family could point to. Maybe we're just a particularly unholy lot, but it's food for thought. Now, the story of the Christian peacemaker teams was a big, dramatic story that got big world attention. So my other story for you is from much closer to home. You may have heard of a man called Marcellus Baz, known just as Baz, who's from Nottingham. He's been in the news a fair bit. So Baz grew up in the Meadows, where he joined a gang. He was heavily involved in dealing drugs and knife crime until he got stabbed by a rival gang. And he turned around in his thinking from that point and found a way to turn his weapons into something good by leaving the gang and setting up a boxing club for disaffected young people and mentoring those who would otherwise be on a route to a violent crime. He now does special free sessions for rival gang members to come together, volunteers 30 hours boxing training a week for young people who need it, is a motivational speaker and spokesperson against knife crime, and has been awarded a British Empire Medal for his work. I don't know if Baz has a faith that guides him in this, but I really learned a lot from his story and felt that it perfectly illustrated someone turning their sword into a plough, that is, transforming a weapon into a tool for growth and nourishment and new life. So how does this all tie in with Micah, and what can we learn from all this? Well, the Israelites Micah was writing to, they were all living in a time of fear. They clung to their fortresses, their soldiers and their swords for their safety, rather than God. And the challenge of this passage, that swords should be beaten into ploughs, requires them to put their fear aside in the face of very real threat and trust instead in God. Unlike the Israelites, we aren't facing a war in this country right now. There might be other things we're afraid of, though, as we've mentioned, and other ways we are acting out of fear, not trust. What are the weapons or defences we might be holding on to protect ourselves? At present, it might be the attic full of loo roll we've hoarded. I do have a few rolls, but I can't answer for you. But my husband Jake and I were talking about this yesterday, and the biggest thing we thought about was money. It was the resources that we have and our purchasing power. We're certainly, by most of the world's standards, living in comfortable luxury. Yet we work to build up savings nonetheless, and pensions and investments in assets like a house. And we hope to build up a war chest, is a term that we kind of often hear about, in case hard times come along. And we're building up this fortress of being independent and isolated, really, self-isolation. And we wondered how we might turn this into a tool for peacemaking, for building bridges, and for protecting other people against violence. I don't know if anyone's been doing the 40 Acts Challenge this Lent. I'm seeing some nods. I haven't done it this Lent, but I did it another Lent. It's really good. But it's the 40 Acts team email you a daily act of generosity challenge. And each challenge that you are emailed has three options, a green, a yellow, and a red option, depending on what scale of challenge you feel up for. So green being easier and red being a little bit more tricky. And considering this question about how Jake and I might lay down our defences and turn them into something that builds bridges, we were thinking through some options, and a green option or an easier option could simply be that we could offer some hospitality using the roof over our heads, the house that we have, not as a safe space to retreat from the world, but a place to build relationships. Perhaps inviting someone round, maybe not in the next couple of months, but at some point in the year, inviting someone round and stay with us for a weekend who we wouldn't usually invite, but we know might be in need of the company. or a change of scene, or even invite someone round for a meal who we haven't always found easy company or seen eye to eye with. This may have to wait, for a couple of months. A yellow option, or a slightly harder challenge, could be practicing a more frugal or simple lifestyle. It sounds all quite like, I don't know, virtuous, but to try and reduce dependence on purchasing power, on that building up of things that we think protect us. During Lent, I've been practicing something called no-spend weekends, where I'm not allowed to spend any money at all on a Saturday or a Sunday. So my shopping sprees have been significantly curbed. And it's forced me to adapt my habits and behaviour. And an afternoon with a friend might be going on a walk or having a back-of-the-cupboard rustle-up lunch at home rather than automatically just gravitating to the nearest cafe and going out. But it makes me more mindful of unnecessary expenditure, demonstrates that I don't need as much as I thought that maybe I did. And finally, the red or much more difficult option could be working with a refugee or a homelessness charity to offer our spare room to someone who needs it on a longer-term basis. It's something I've thought about in the past a bit and I'm still considering, but I've not done it before, investigated it at all. But if anyone in the church has any experience of doing something like this, I would genuinely love to hear about it and your experiences. So that's just my own example and my own thought process in response to the question of what are the weapons or defences that we need to lay down and how might we start doing this. But only you can answer that for yourself. So the question that I'll leave you to think about through the week is simply, what are your weapons or defences? What are the things that you carry around out of fear and hold on to out of fear to protect yourself? And how might these be laid down or transformed into tools to bring peace, to nurture, or to create new life?